Okay, let's begin. Okay. So what I said last time was the following, and this is the problem that we arrived at last time. I said, if you try to solve an equation like, say, ut equals uxx, using a Taylor series, the Taylor series incorporates the initial condition right away at the beginning. And the work consists of finding the Taylor coefficients that sum the series. Okay, that's where the non-trivial work is. But what we said was, if we want to solve this equation in the form of a Fourier series, the Fourier series will have the form, and I'm using a Fourier sine series, okay, it will have the form a sub n, well, let's write a sub n sine of nx, okay, times e to the minus n squared times t, and this is the Fourier series representation for a solution of this equation that sits between, here's the x-axis, here's the t-axis, and the solution sits in this region, okay? So we're finding a solution that that sits between x equals 0 and x equals pi, and for all t, okay? And the problem here is to find a way to incorporate the initial condition, okay? So the problem that we set about solving was that u is equal to 0 here, that is, u of 0 and t is equal to 0 here, u of pi and t is equal to 0 here, and over here, u of x and 0 is f of x. And the problem that we faced was how to incorporate f of x, the initial condition, into this series. Okay, and you can see that u of x and 0 is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a sub n sine of nx. Okay, just setting t equal to 0. So the question is, if u of x and 0 is f of x, you know, we're given f of x, and we have a Fourier series, but the point is, how do we find the coefficients a sub n such that when you put it into this Fourier series, you recover f of x? In other words, given a function, how do you find its Fourier series representation? And what you are taught in elementary courses on Fourier series, and this is very sloppy thinking and not always valid, what you're taught is that the Fourier sine, these Fourier functions, the sine functions, sine of nx, are orthogonal. They form an orthogonal set of functions. And therefore, what you're taught is you should multiply both sides by sine of mx and integrate. But we don't know whether or not you can integrate term by term, because we don't know what the series is yet. So we did something really clever. What we did was to say, define. We said, let us define a sub n to be the result that you get from multiplying by sine of mx and integrating. Okay, we'll simply ignore the possible problem, and we will make a definition. We will say the nth Fourier coefficient is the integral from 0 to pi times 2 over pi dx sine of nx times f of x. That's a definition. Okay? And nobody can argue with that definition, but we have two things that we have to prove. Okay? The first thing that we have to discuss is, does the sum of a sub n sine of nx converge? We don't know whether or not what we get, whether or not this sum from 1 to infinity, will converge. And the second question is, does this sum converge to f of x? Because it might converge, but it might converge to a different function and not to the original function f of x. We don't know. Okay? And what I showed you was two different functions. I looked at the function x times pi minus x. Okay, we looked at this function, and we found that it converged to the function just graphically, just doing a numerical study. It converged to this function very, very well, very rapidly. Okay, that was the first numerical example I showed you. And the second numerical example I showed you was for the function f of x equals 1. Now, this looks crazy. And that's because the function f of 1 does not vanish at x equals 0. And what we saw was that the Fourier series from 0 to pi seemed to converge to 1 in the interior of the interval, okay, with very small oscillations about the function 1. Okay. But as you approach the edge of the interval, what happened was there were oscillations like this, okay, that look like this. And there is what is called here an overshoot. And if you look carefully at it, the overshoot is actually 18% high, which is crazy. Really interesting. Okay? The reason that this overshoot is happening, this is called the Gibbs phenomenon. Okay? The Gibbs phenomenon. And the Gibbs phenomenon occurs when this series converges but does not converge uniformly. Okay? That is to say, the rate of convergence of the series depends on x. Okay? So this is what I'm going to tell you today. First of all, I want to show you, we certainly know that in order for this series to converge, the coefficients a sub n have to go to 0. And I want to show you the condition, I want you to understand how we can know, at least in many cases, that these coefficients do go to 0. And the second point is, we have to make sure that they go to 0 fast enough. Okay? And I'm going to try to show you ways of determining how fast these coefficients go to 0. Then I want to show you that the Fourier series for the function f of x equals 1 really converges to 1. I'm going to actually show you that it converges to 1. I'm going to demonstrate that, which is really interesting, okay, because the proof is really cool. Okay? Then, having done that, I want to show you why or how we can accelerate the convergence of a Fourier series and take it from a series that is not uniformly convergent to one that is uniformly convergent. Okay, that's powerful. And that's stuff that is not normally taught in a course on Fourier series. And then, armed with that, I want to show you how powerful we really are. If you didn't know what I'm going to teach you today, I hope we can say all this today. If not, we'll run over a little bit into tomorrow. But if you didn't know this, and you had a problem that you tried to solve using a Fourier series, you would be stunned at how lousy the Fourier series really is until you started to use acceleration of convergence. And that's what this course is about. Why it is that when you learn how to sum a series, you suddenly are powerful. Because then, for the first time, you can use the methods that have been taught to you in standard courses on mathematical methods. Okay? That's the point. So, first of all, how do you show that the a sub n go to 0, and how fast the a sub n go to 0? And let me, again, mention a theorem that I talked about last time, and that is this. This integral, the integral from 0 to pi dx, doesn't have to be from 0 to pi. It could be from anything to anything. Dx sine of nx f of x goes to 0 if f of x is a reasonable function. Okay, so what does that mean, a reasonable function? Well, it has to be absolutely integrable. Okay, and it is sufficient if f of x is continuous. This goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. That's a fact. Let's write it, fact. Okay, this goes to 0 as n goes to infinity because of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay, and I'm not going to prove this to you. You can look up the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, which is an which is about oscillation integrals that of integrands that are oscillating. But you can understand heuristically why this is true. It's true simply because if you let n get very, very large, then sine of x is oscillating very, very quickly. Now, f of x is some function or other, and we don't really care what f of x is. It's some function that might be, you know, if you made a plot of f of x, it's some function that's looking like this. Who cares what it looks like? Okay. On a very tiny interval, this function is roughly constant. Okay. But as n gets very, very big, the sine function is oscillating like mad inside of that interval. Okay. And therefore, the positive contributions cancel the negative contributions. And the area under this curve is very small. It's of order 1 over n. Okay? It's what you would get if you simply integrated the sine function with f of x just being a constant, 1. Okay? Now, of course, f of x is varying. But on each of these intervals, f of x is hardly varying. Okay? And we can take more and more intervals, take the intervals tinier and tinier. And that's basically how you prove the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay, and you conclude that this integral itself is going to 0. That's what the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says. However, what it doesn't say, it's frustrating. It says this integral goes to 0. But it doesn't tell you how fast it goes to 0. And we, as physicists, or as applied mathematicians, or scientists in general, we need to know how fast the coefficients go to 0. And the question is, how do you determine that? And the answer is, it's actually, for most cases, it's relatively simple. All we do is, or do you know? Can you guess what we do? How would we study this integral for large n? What would you do? This is a fancy theorem about mathematics, but what would you do? You know, someone handed you, you know, you're walking down the street, someone comes up to you and says, does this integral go to 0 as n goes to infinity? Yeah.
It should be counted by absolute integral of f. Oh, wait, that doesn't matter. Right?
Yeah, it's true that that's you can put an upper bound, but that's not, we want to know how fast it goes to 0.
Because the upper bound is,
yeah. So how do we do a study of this for large n? What did you just say?
The ratio of the terms.
Yeah, that's what we'll, yeah, so the question is, how does a sub n behave, as n goes to infinity? What tool should we use?
Change of values.
How about just integration by parts? Integration by parts is the most powerful tool for solving the for determining the asymptotic behavior of an integral. That's all. Just integration by parts. Okay, and let's try and use integration by parts to see how this integral does behave for large n. Okay, so the integral for a sub n, if we do an integration by parts on this integral, let's integrate sine of x and differentiate the function f of x. Okay, so the first term that you get when you integrate by parts is an evaluation from 0 to pi. The integral of sine of x is minus cosine of nx over n times f of x. Okay? And then we have minus the integral where I differentiate f, okay, which is already a minus sign, so it becomes plus the integral from 0 to pi dx f prime of x cosine of nx over n. Okay? Now, I'm assuming, of course, that f prime of x exists. I'm a physicist, and I'm not going to worry about some crazy function that a mathematician might have dreamt up for me. Of course, we have to worry about that. But let's look at this term here. There are two possibilities. Either this term happens to be 0, or it isn't 0. Okay? How could this term be 0? Well, this term vanishes if f of 0 is equal to 0 and f of pi is equal to 0. Is that clear? Because it vanishes at the endpoints. Okay? If f of 0 is not 0 and or f of pi is not 0, then this term, how big is this term? It's of order 1 over n. Okay, and this is the key thing about Fourier series. This term is of order 1 over n. We know more than we would have learned just from quoting the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. We now know how fast this integral vanishes. It vanishes like 1 over n. What about this integral? Well, by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, there's already a factor here of 1 over n. You see that, right? 1 over n is out front. And assuming that the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma holds here, this vanishes, goes to 0, as n goes to infinity by the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay? So therefore, this is smaller than this. I don't know how much smaller, but it certainly is smaller than this. So the issue is, does f of x vanish at 0 and pi or not? If it doesn't, then we know that a sub n goes like 1 over n. And that is exactly what happened in the second example that I showed you. In this case, a sub n goes like 1 over n for large n. However, in this case, you notice that you see why I chose this function. This function has the property that it vanishes at 0 and vanishes at pi. In fact, it's the simplest function I can give you. That vanishes both at 0 and at pi. That's why I chose that function. Okay? If this does vanish, okay, then there is no contribution from here at all. And we have to study this integral for large n. What do you recommend I do to study this integral for large n? Okay. That's good. So we're going to integrate this by parts. Okay, so this integral here, if I use integration by parts, gives me, this is equal to, now, I'm going to integrate cosine, and I'm going to differentiate f prime. If I integrate cosine, I get an evaluation from 0 to pi of 1 over n squared. Notice there's an additional factor of n that comes into the denominator. I have sine of nx times f prime of x minus the integral from 0 to pi, 1 over n squared, times f prime prime of x sine of nx dx. OK? That's a dx over here. All right. Now, let's look at this piece. Now something very, very nice happens that didn't happen before. I want you to notice that sine vanishes at the endpoints. We don't care whether or not f prime of 0 happens to be 0 or f prime of pi happens to be 0. We don't care about it because the sine vanishes. So that piece is already gone, and it's always gone, assuming that f prime is well behaved at the endpoints. Okay, it's not blowing up or anything crazy. Okay, so now we have this integral. Okay, and we have to study this integral for large n. Okay, I'm going to ask you a stupid question. What do we do? Integration by parts. Okay, and if we do integration by parts, what we will find is that this goes for large n like 1 over n cubed, because the entire argument is repeated. This is already the Fourier coefficients for the function f double prime of x, okay, And we know this will go like 1 over n cubed if f prime prime of 0, or I should say and, or f prime prime of pi is not equal to 0. Okay? But what happens if, okay, so if f prime prime of 0 equals f prime prime of pi equals 0, then how fast will the Fourier coefficient go to 0? Say it again. We're going to have to integrate by parts again. Do you see the pattern? How fast will it go to 0? 1 over n to the 5. That's right. N to the 5. Unless f prime 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 of 0 equals f prime 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 of pi equals 0, in which case a sub n goes to 0, is going to 0 very rapidly, like 1 over n to the 7, and so on. Okay? Yes, you have a question?
What then is the difference between this Fourier method and Taylor series? Because with Taylor series, we expected the function to be infinitely differentiable.
If we have a... Okay, we will go back to Taylor series. But the point is that when you expand a function in a Taylor series converges very rapidly. Okay? Taylor series always converge geometrically. So a Taylor series of the form a sub n x to the n, okay, if you are inside of the radius of convergence, then, you know, let's suppose this converges for x less than some r, that means that these coefficients are going to 0 like, how fast? These must go to 0 like 1 over r to the n, 1 over r to the n. So that means Taylor series converge like a shot. They're wonderful. They converge very rapidly when they converge. Okay? If they don't converge, they diverge very rapidly. Okay? They blow up geometrically. Okay? So Taylor series converge very rapidly. This is not true of, in general, of Fourier series. It's very rare for a Fourier series to converge very rapidly. Okay, typically, the Fourier series converges only algebraically, not geometrically. Geometrically means like powers of, you know, like a constant to a power. Here, this convergence is very, very slow in general. Now, the key question here is whether or not the Fourier coefficients go to 0. So here, how fast do these Fourier coefficients go to 0? What do we expect on the basis of this? Like 1 over n cubed. That's right. Okay, that's what we expect, and that's what we found. Yeah.
All our even variables are 0. Doesn't this go to, like, can we just do this forever?
Yes. Yes, yes. That means that it converges faster than any power, and this happens, in fact, in the problem that I posed. Okay, that's a very good question, and that happens precisely for this problem. Can you tell me why it happens? Why is that true for this problem? Can you see why that might be true? Maybe you didn't hear the question. The question is, suppose the even derivatives at the origin and at pi are always 0. Then, and only then, do we have a Fourier series that converges the way a Taylor series likes to converge. Geometrically, very, very fast, faster than any algebraic power of 1 over n. Okay? Converges like a shot. And that, as I was saying, happens in particular for this problem. Can you tell me why it happens? Why does it happen? Yeah.
Those functions with even derivatives going to 0 look
like, I didn't hear it, because
those functions look a lot like sines already.
No, it vanishes as a consequence, as a specific consequence of this problem here. Can you explain why? You see, we assumed that the temperature is 0 all along here, and 0 along here. But we are solving the heat equation. Ut equals uxx. So let's look at the heat equation as we approach the wall. Okay? At the wall, namely where x is equal to 0, it says ut of 0 and t is equal to uxx at 0 and t. If u vanishes on the wall, u is 0, then if we take the time derivative along the wall, the time derivative also vanishes. And as a consequence of the heat equation itself, it says that the second derivative also vanishes. Now, did you follow that? Okay. So now let's take the derivative of the heat equation. UTXX is equal to UXXXX. Okay? But we already know this vanishes at the wall, that UXX vanishes at the wall. And therefore, the time derivative of that vanishes at the wall because we're taking a derivative in the vertical direction. Therefore, U4X is equal to 0. So now let's take the derivative of this equation. UTXXXX is equal to UXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXX x is equal to 0 all along the wall. So if we take the time derivative of that, that is the vertical derivative, we're not taking a derivative horizontally because it would be changing, but the derivative in the time direction, that vanishes. And therefore, this vanishes at the wall, and so on, and so on, and so on. And therefore, this is your question. You know, this is an explicit example of your question. And therefore, we expect that the solution to the heat equation, when expressed as a Fourier series, is fantastic. The Fourier series is absolutely perfect for solving this problem. Okay? Unfortunately, this problem is trivial. Okay, but shall we look at the solution? Let's actually look at the solution and verify that what we just said is true. We already know the solution. In fact, it's written down. It's right in front of you, right here. Okay? These numbers, a sub n, come from this equation right here. They're just a bunch of numbers. I don't care what those numbers are. But look at this. E to the minus n squared of t. That's how rapidly it converges. So this converges much faster than algebraic. This is very rapid convergence. That's why the Fourier series is so good for solving the heat equation for this problem. Okay? So we didn't have to go through this proof. All we had to do was to look at the answer. There it is. Okay? Okay, so this function, e to the minus n squared times t, says that the Fourier coefficients, the things multiplying sine of nx, go to 0 very, very rapidly. Okay, now, are you with me? You look like you have something's bothering you.
Sorry, you said because we have factor e, the an go to 0 very rapidly?
No, it's not this. These are numbers that come from here. These numbers, let's suppose that u of x and 0 doesn't vanish at 0 and pi. So these numbers here go to 0 like 1 over n. But look, look at that. As soon as t is bigger than 0, t could be any number bigger than 0, 1. Okay? If t is 1, this coefficient is only falling off like 1 over n. But this goes like, sorry? Like but an still goes to 0 like 1 over n.
If they blew up, then like they could be the effect.
Yes, even if an blew up, this would overcome that. But if an blew up, that means that we have a singularity at x equals 0, and then the solution to the heat equation might have a problem. It might not exist. But we're not going to worry about that. Okay? So the answer to your question is that we have this thing sitting right in front of us, and this is an example of where you have a very rapid convergence of a Fourier series. But you can see that this is very rare. Because what is the chance in real life? I mean, you know, you're solving a problem for your thesis, let's say. What is the chance in real life that f will vanish at 0 and pi? F's second derivative will vanish at 0 and pi. The fourth derivative of f will vanish at 0 and pi. Whew. This is a rare and wonderful thing if it happens, but it sure is rare. OK? All right, now, the issue, the important issue is this. And this is something that you will discuss today, right, in the tutorial this afternoon. The important issue is simply this. Does a sub n go to 0 like 1 over n? Or does it go to 0 faster than 1 over n? The key thing is 1 over n. Why? And the reason is because if a sub n goes to 0, OK, if a sub n goes to 0 like 1 over n, then it means that the Fourier series, this Fourier series that we've written down, this thing here, typically it will converge, but it will not converge uniformly. That is because it does not converge absolutely. So the speed of convergence will depend on x. Okay? But it still will converge. So I want, and if a sub n goes to 0 faster than 1 over n, then this Fourier series here, this guy, the coefficients in this series go to 0 faster than 1 over n, then this series will be absolutely convergent. The series does not rely on the fact that the sine function is sometimes positive and sometimes negative, and it cancels in a delicate way, and it produces a delicate convergence. Okay. So I want to show you that the answer to the question number one and the question number two is yes, at least for one function. I don't want to spend, you know, the whole 2 weeks of lecture. I want to try to finish Fourier series today. But at least for one function, I want to show you how the Fourier series really does converge to the function f of x equals 1. Because you may not believe that it does. You have every right not to believe it does. You could ask, how in the world could it be that I can represent the function f of x equals 1 using a Fourier series? And I'm going to show you that you can. And I'm going to show you how it works. Okay? So I want to prove okay? That's what I want to do. Okay? And I think the proof is extremely instructive because it will reveal the nature of the convergence. Okay, how do we prove that? Well, we're going to need two facts. We're going to need this fact over here, the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, but we're going to need one other fact. And I'm not going to prove that to you if you don't know how to derive it, we can derive it. But I'm going to use one other fact, an important fact, and that is that the integral from 0 to infinity, dx sine of x over x, what is that equal to? Does anybody know? Very good. How'd you know that? Oh, never mind. You knew it. That's terrific. That's right. That's exactly right. You can do it. In fact, you don't have to know complex variables to do it. You can evaluate this integral using the techniques of freshman calculus. However, it requires some cleverness. But you can actually evaluate this integral using freshman calculus alone and get pi over 2. And in fact, I'll leave that as a challenge for you. Okay? So question, can you, using nothing more than real variables, that is, elementary freshman calculus, can you show that this integral is equal to pi over 2? Using complex variables, you had a course in complex variables. Using complex variables, you can show it right away. And that involves the use of a principal part integral and shifting a contour and Jordan's lemma and a few other facts, features about contour integration, okay? And you can derive it in just 4 or 5 lines. But the question is, how do you do this using only freshman calculus? That's an interesting question. Okay, anyway, so what I would like to do is I would like to study the function f of x equals 1, derive its Fourier series, and show that the Fourier series converges. That's what I want to do. So first thing we need to know is, what are the Fourier coefficients? OK, and we have a formula for them. And we know that a sub n is 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi dx times 1, just 1, that's the function that we're expanding, right, times sine of nx. Well, this is easy. I can just evaluate the integral, and I get 2 over pi times n with a minus sign cosine of nx evaluated from 0 to pi, right? And at, what is this? At pi, cosine of nx is minus 1 to the n. OK? And at 0, cosine of nx is 1. So if I evaluate the integral, I get minus 1 to the n minus 1. OK? Now, if n is even, if n is an even integer, this is 1 minus 1. And you get 0, right? That's not, that's pretty simple. So a sub n is equal to 0 if n is even. What if n is odd? Well, if n is an odd number, that is minus 1. Here's another minus 1. So these two guys combine to make minus 2. And they multiply minus 2 over pi n, so you get 4 over pi times n. So the Fourier series for the function f of x equals 1 is precisely, that Fourier series is precisely the sum from n equals 0 to infinity. And I'm just going to sum over odd numbers. So it's sine of 2n plus 1 over 2n plus 1 times 4 over pi. That should be the Fourier series for 1. OK, well, the question is it equal to 1? Sine x, yeah, thank you. Yeah. OK, and the question is, does this series, you notice for large n, it's going to 0 like 1 over n, as we said. OK, for large n, this goes to 0 like 1 over n. Explicitly, it goes to 0 like a constant times 1 over n. OK? And the question is, does this series converge? That's not obvious. So let's see if we can examine this series. So what should we do? The first thing we should do is, when you study the convergence of a series, what do you do? You ask, do the partial sums of the series approach 1? That's the question. So what do I mean by the partial sum? The sum of n terms in the series. That means the sum from n equals 0 to capital N, 4 over pi sine of 2n plus 1 times x over 2n plus 1. OK? The question is, this is the nth partial sum. Question is, does Sn approach 1 as n goes to infinity? Question. That's what we need to look at. OK? So this, of course, is a function of x. And this is quite remarkable, because you see what's happening. This is a function of x over here. Sn depends on x. And yet, the question is, as n goes to infinity, does this approach something that's independent of x? Just 1. Where does the x dependence go? How could it disappear? This is really weird if it works. Okay, do you all understand the problem then? Okay, so let's try to calculate this function here. What is that sum? Let's see if we can actually perform the sum. Now, this is not an easy sum to evaluate. What's the difficulty with summing this, with calculating this sum? If you were given a sum like this, what is the hard part about this sum? This is only a finite sum, of course. What's the hard part? Yeah, we want to do it for every x. But what is it that makes this sum difficult to evaluate? It's not the sine. Because you see, the sine function, what is sine? Sine of is e to the I minus e to the minus I. Okay? And if I'm summing over n, that's just a geometric series. I can sum a geometric series. The problem is not the sine. The problem is that stupid denominator. That's the problem. And I would like to get rid of the denominator. And I can do it very easily. Instead of trying to calculate Sn of x, I will calculate Sn prime of x. Because if I take the derivative of this, the denominator, the thing that makes it hard, will go away. Okay? So this is the sum from n equals 0 to capital N. And there's this factor of 4 over pi here. And when I take a derivative, I get cosine of 2n plus 1 times x. That's what I get. That's very nice. Now, you know what cosine is. You know the formula for cosine. Cosine of a is e to the ia plus e to the minus ia over 2, right? So therefore, if I were to write out all the terms in this series, you know what it would be. It would be, there's a 2, of course. Each cosine has a 2 in the denominator. So it would give me a factor of 2 over pi. Okay, and what would the terms in this series look like? Well, the term with the most negative I in the exponent would be e to the minus I times 2 capital N plus 1 times x, right? And then the next cosine would give me e to the minus I 2n minus 1 times x, and so on. And I would have more and more terms until I got to the one which had the most positive thing in the numerator, which would correspond to the nth term here again, which would be e to the I times 2n plus 1 times x. This is a geometric series. In fact, maybe I can write it in a little bit more transparent way. If I factor out, let me factor out the most negative term. So we only deal with positive things up in the exponent. So I could write this as 2 over pi times e to the minus I times 2n plus 1 times x. Now, when I factor that out, the first term is 1. The second term is e to the 2ix plus e to the 4ix plus e to the 6ix and so on, all the way up to e to the 2n plus 2ix. OK? And this is a geometric series. Of course, we don't want to try to sum this as an infinite geometric series. Why? Yeah.
Actually, I thought I knew.
Okay.
I was going to say that maybe the absolute value is not less than 1, but that's why?
That's exactly right. Oh. Yeah, that's precisely the reason why. The point is, if I take each of the, so what is the common ratio? You know, the question is, what is the sum of the series in general? 1 plus r squared plus da-da-da-da plus r to the n. What is the sum of this series? The sum of this series is 1 minus r to the n plus 1. Good. OK. Over 1 minus r. OK, that's the sum of the series. And this is an exact algebraic identity. Okay, this is an algebraic identity. It doesn't matter what R is. We don't care what R is, except, of course, if R is equal to 1. Okay, but if R is equal to 1, there are n plus 1 terms in the series, so the sum is n plus 1. That's it. Okay, we don't want R to be 1 because we don't want this denominator to vanish. Okay, but if R is not equal to 1, that's the sum of the series. And I've been very, very careful here to write down a finite sum. If you have an infinite sum, then R in absolute value must be less than 1. Because if we let capital N go off to infinity, this numerator here may blow up. In fact, it will blow up if R in absolute value is bigger than 1. It will be ambiguous if R in absolute value is 1. And it will converge, it will go to 0, if R in absolute value is less than 1. Okay, do you all understand that? So how about that? I have summed the series. Okay? The answer is first we have this garbage out front, which is 2 over pi e to the minus I 2n plus 1 times x. And now, the sum of this series, I just used my plug-in formula. The sum of the series is 1 minus, well, let's write down the denominator, 1 minus r. R, in this case, is just 2ix, e to the 2ix. Okay, e to the 2ix. And in the numerator, it's e to the 2ix raised to the power n plus 1. But what's n here? It's this power here, okay, plus 1. Okay, I mean, let's write this as e to the n plus 1 times 2ix. So that the last term has the power n plus 1, so I have to increase that by 1. So this is n plus 2. Okay? Is that clear? Zach, you following? So that's the sum of the series. How do you like that? That's pretty impressive. And if I, let's try just doing a little algebra to simplify that. If I multiply this out on top, the first term I get is e to the minus I times 2n plus 1 x. The second term is there's a 4.
4n plus 2.
Yeah. This is 4n. This is 2n plus 2. Yeah. Just a second. This is r, which is e to the 2ix, times this power, which is n plus 1, right? So this is...
Should be 2n plus 1, this one. Like
this is...
It should be 2n plus 1 just before 4n plus 2.
Why should it be 2n plus 1?
Because you start with exponential of minus I 2n plus 1x, 2 lines above.
Yes, I have pulled it out. So this should be 4n plus, you're absolutely right, over here. This should be, not this, but this should be, because I pulled it out, this should be 4n plus 2. That's right. You're absolutely right. So therefore, the power here, factoring out the 2, is 2n plus 1. That's correct. And so here, this is 2ix times 2n plus 1. Okay. So if we multiply this out, we get e to the, and now it's 4n plus 2 minus 2n plus 1, which is 2n plus, this is Okay, so this is 4n. This should be 2n on, this should be 4n plus 2 here, this thing here.
No, but in the bracket, it should be 2n plus 2.
2n plus 2, yeah. So that's right, 4n plus 4. So this is now 2n plus 3, I guess. Okay, there we go. Times ix, okay? Now, this is still kind of messy, but why don't we pull out a factor of e to the ix from the numerator and the denominator, because I think that'll make that a little bit more symmetric. So this is now 2 over pi times e to the minus ix minus e to the ix. I'm pulling out a factor of this, okay? So I'm multiplying the top and the bottom by e to the minus ix. And on the top, I will have e to the minus I times 2n plus 2x. And here, I will have minus e to the 2n plus 2 ix. Okay? And this is a little bit more symmetric because I have a 2n plus 2 and a minus 2n plus 2 here, and just a 1 and a minus 1 here. Okay? Ah, but I recognize this. In fact, if I take the numerator and divide by 2i, and take the denominator and divide by 2i, you see this is just the definition of a sine function. Do you see that? So after the algebra, what I get is sine of x in the denominator and sine of 2n plus 2 times x in the numerator. And that is really pretty. So hang on a second. Let me just summarize what we've shown. We have shown, what are we trying to do? Our objective was to calculate the partial sum. We didn't know how to calculate the partial sum because of this stupid thing in the denominator. So we decided we would calculate the derivative of the partial sum, and we have now shown that s prime of x, the derivative of the partial sum, is 2 over pi times sine of 2n plus 2 times x over sine of x. And we haven't made any approximation. This is an exact answer, okay? But we haven't calculated the partial sum. Yeah?
Did we specifically say x not 0?
We are specifically saying x is not 0, because remember I said we do not want r to be 1. Okay? So x is not 0. And also, similarly, x is not pi.
So are we going to be keeping that one separate?
That's right. That's right. So here, at this point, we were making the assumption that x is not equal to 0 or pi, because otherwise r would be equal to 1. Okay, because we specifically made that assumption. Okay, and this is what we get. That's the answer. But we don't want that. We want to know what is s of x. Well, you know what s of x is. S sub n of x would be the integral of this. Okay, it would be the integral up to x dt times 2 over pi sine of 2n plus 2 times t over sine of t. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking to yourself, wait a minute. We started out to try to sum a series that was very difficult to sum, and we have replaced it by an integral that's very difficult to do. In fact, we don't even know what the endpoint on the integral is, unless you can help me. What do I put at the lower limit there?
A bit bigger than 0?
Say it again?
A little bit bigger than 0?
For 0, I could put epsilon if you like, but I can take epsilon to be 0 because nothing singular happens at 0. You notice that this has no problem existing, and this is 0, okay, why is that? Because S sub n of 0 is equal to 0. Obviously, the partial sums all vanish at x equals 0. If you look at this partial sum and you plug in x equals 0, it vanishes. And so that's what determines the endpoint. But this is a very hard integral. I don't know how to evaluate sine of 2n plus 2 times t over sine of t. So I need a trick. Okay? So here's the trick. Okay. Here is the problem. The problem is that there's a sine of t in the denominator. I could do this integral easily if it didn't have a sine of t in the denominator, but it has a sine of t. And that's very complicated. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to subtract 1 over t, and I'm going to add back 1 over t. Okay? And I'm going to consider two separate integrals. One is this integral, and the other is that integral. Okay? So this will be the integral, we'll call that I1, and this is the integral I2. I1 is the integral sine of 2n plus 2t divided by, or rather times, 1 over sine of t minus 1 over t. However, how does this integral behave as n goes to infinity? What happens if n is going to infinity in this integral? X is fixed. Okay, we are integrating from 0 to x. X is a fixed number. How does that integral behave as n goes to infinity, and why? Okay, say who said it goes to 0? Exactly right. You're exactly right. By the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, that goes to 0. Why does it go to 0? Because here we have an oscillating function, rapidly oscillating as n goes to infinity. And here is a well-behaved function. Why is it well-behaved? Sine of t vanishes at t equals 0, doesn't it? Okay, so it blows up. But I'm subtracting off the thing that blows up. So this is a smooth function at t equals 0. So this contribution, I1, just goes to 0 as n goes to infinity, which is really interesting, really nice. And what I'm left with is I2. And I2 is a much simpler integral to evaluate. What is that integral? It is 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to x dt sine of 2n plus 2 times t divided by t. Okay, I heard you say it. Why am I getting... So now, what is the last step in my calculation? What am I going to do?
Is this the sine nx over x?
Yes. So what you say is I should just scale, right? I should multiply t here by 2n plus 2. Everywhere t appears, I multiply it by 2n plus 2. And then I change variables. I'll call this variable whatever you like, s. And so this is the integral of 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to x times 2n plus 2, okay, times ds sine of s over s. But I have told you that this integral is equal to pi over 2, which cancels the 2 over pi, and therefore this guy is 1 in the limit as n goes to infinity. Isn't that beautiful? So the Fourier series converges to 1, and we proved it, which is really interesting. Okay? Except near 0. And the question is, what happens I mean, this is extraordinary, okay? And you can do this proof for any function. we don't have to do the function f of x equals 1. It's just a little bit messier. But the proof is identical. How do you prove that a Fourier series converges? That's how you prove that the Fourier series converges to the function that it represents. But the question is, what happens to the Fourier series near 0? And what do we mean by near 0? I mean near x equals 0. How do we study how the Fourier series behaves near x equals 0? Well, now, you understand, we have shown that Sn of x, this thing goes to 0. The interesting integral that we are looking at is the integral of 2 over pi times, it's this one right here, integral from 0 to x times 2n plus 2. We'll write it that way. Times ds times sine of s over s. Okay? How does this thing behave when x is near 0? What do I mean by x near 0? Okay? So what I mean is, suppose x is of order 1 over 2n plus 2. Okay. In field theory, if you're studying quantum field theory, this is called the double scaling limit of a quantum field theory. This is precisely what is meant by a double scaling limit in a quantum field theory. In this context, which is much simpler and I don't have to use fancy words, what do I mean? I mean, suppose x goes to 0, but n goes to infinity at the same time. Okay? X goes to 0, n goes to infinity at the same time. That's what I mean by near 0. So that the product of x times 2n plus 2 is just some constant like alpha. Okay? Then, what is this function? This function is 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to alpha ds sine of s over s. And this function actually has a name. Do any of you know what this function is called? This, very good. What? It's the sine integral function. Okay. So this is 2 over pi times si of alpha. That's what it's called. Okay? Okay, you can't evaluate this integral, so you just give the function a new name and you proceed. Okay? It's what biologists do, you know. They look out at the complicated biological world around us and they name everything. That doesn't mean they understand everything, they just have a name for everything. So we don't understand this integral because we can't evaluate it, but we'll give it a name, si. Okay, so it's some transcendental function. However, we can discuss its properties. And what are the properties of this function si of alpha? Well, you know freshman calculus. If you saw a new function, what's the first thing you would do? You would find its maxima and its minima and where it passes through 0 and so on. What do you know about this function? Well, si of 0 is certainly 0. Okay. And if you looked for the maxima and minima of this function, what would you do? You would take its derivative, si prime of alpha. Well, taking the derivative is trivial. We just simply remove the integral sign, and it's equal to sine of s over s. And so this function has maxima and minima at s equals pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, 4 pi, and so on. That's where the function has a zero derivative. And so we would like to know, for example, what does the plot of this function look like? And we can say right away what the function looks like. It starts, if I plot si of alpha as a function of alpha, it starts at 0. At pi, it has a maximum. At 2 pi, it has a minimum. At 3 pi, it has a maximum again. At 4 pi, it has a minimum. And it oscillates, and it approaches a constant. And you know what the constant is. What's the constant? Pi over 2, because we just evaluated that. So out here, it approaches the constant pi over 2. And that's what the function looks like. And the interesting question is, how big is this function at its maximum? We know exactly where the maximum is. It's at pi. How big is the function? Well, to find out how high that function is, we would have to evaluate the integral from 0 to pi ds sine of s over s. And I don't know how to do that integral. OK, it's just some number. And if I put it on a computer, this number is approximately 1.85. It's a very important number. So if you want to know how big the partial sum is, what number does the partial sum approach, s sub n as n goes to infinity, at this point, where alpha is equal to pi, it approaches 2 over pi times 1.85. And 2 over pi times 1.85 is approximately 1.18. And that is the 18% overshoot. So conclusion, as n goes to infinity, as n is running off to infinity, this is the x-axis. OK, this is x equals 0. What does the Fourier series look like? OK, what does s sub n of x approach? That's what I'm plotting on this axis. So at x equals 0, what does it approach? 0. OK? Then, at a very, very, very small distance from the origin. How big is the distance? The distance is of order 1 over 2n plus 1, or 2n plus 2. Okay, so it's a very, very small distance, because n is going to infinity. What happens? This goes up and reaches a maximum of 1.18. And then it goes down to a minimum, and a maximum, minimum, maximum, minimum. But these things are getting smaller. And eventually, it approaches 1. And it stays 1 all the way on the interval until it gets to pi. And then it does exactly the same thing. And that's because the function 1 is symmetric about pi over 2. Okay, and the sine functions are symmetric about pi over 2. So they begin to oscillate again. And they go up to this number 1.18. And then they come down to 0. And as n goes off to infinity, what happens? All of this junk over here and all of that junk over here gets compressed because the size of this region, the size of this region where all this Gibbs oscillation is occurring, is of order 1 over 2n plus 2. So as n goes to infinity, this region crunches down to the origin, and so it goes like this. The picture looks like this. Here's 1. Here's pi over here. How does the Fourier series behave? It starts at 0. It goes straight up like that, because n is infinity now. And it goes up to the point 1.18, and it goes dee 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 dee. OK? Because you can't see it, because n is infinity now. And then it's 1. It's just wonderful. It approximates the function 1 until it gets to the end, the very end. And then it goes dee 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 dee. And then like that. Whoops. Pi. OK? So all this happens in a very, very, very small region. It's compressed. This is what happens with non-uniform convergence of a Fourier series. If the convergence of the Fourier series were uniform, then it wouldn't depend on x. we wouldn't have this consideration, these special considerations of x, these special values of x, this special region of x. Okay? So only when you have non-uniform convergence do you have this Gibbs oscillation in a very, very small region. I mean, when I say a small region, this region is of order, you know, 1 over the national debt. Okay? Very, very small. That's where this oscillation occurs. Everywhere else, it has converged to the function 1. Okay? So now, let me show you. Okay, so this lecture actually turned out to be pretty well timed. So we're almost at the end. But let me show you what I mean now, for the first time, by acceleration of convergence of a Fourier series. Okay? Yeah?
Where can we see this overshoot on the other side? Because if you take...
Oh, we have to... We didn't do that. Okay, so you would have to do a study of this. You would have to examine... You have to replace x by pi minus y and study this as a function of y. And you just use a few algebraic identities and then look what happens when y is small. Okay, and but the point is, I don't have to do that for you because I know that everything I've done is symmetric about the point pi over 2. The sine function, you know, looks like this. Here is pi over 2, and we're looking at this interval here. And we're only looking at sine or odd sine functions. So the odd sine function is also symmetric. Every odd sine function is symmetric about pi over 2, so I don't have to... You could do that as an exercise, but there's no point. Okay. So the question is, okay, now this is what I want you to think about. This is going to be discussed in the tutorial today at some length, but this is now the point. Okay? But I'm not yet going to go to solving a heat equation problem. That I'm going to do next time. But let me give you a simple problem. You're walking down the street, and a guy comes up to you and says, I, in my research, have come up with the following Fourier series. Sum from n equals 1 to infinity, sine of nx times, you know, what we're calling a sub n, okay? And he says, my a sub n happens to be e to the 1 over n minus 1. Never mind where it comes from. This is what he did in his research, okay? The guy comes up to you and he says, this is a Fourier series that I've been struggling with, okay? And can you help me with this Fourier series? In particular, can you tell me, this is representing some function in this guy's research, and he says to you, can you tell me, please, what is f of 0? What's f of pi? How do I calculate f of x? You know, how do I do an efficient calculation of f of x? And you look at the guy, and with a glum, he has a very glum expression on his face. And you look at the guy and you say, I know why you have a glum expression on your face. That's because as n goes off to infinity, e to the 1 over n minus 1, how does that behave? It behaves like 1 over n. Okay? That's because for large n, this is 1 plus 1 over n plus 1 over 2n squared and so on, right? And this the ones cancel, okay? And this goes like 1 over n. So you look at the guy and you say, I know why you have a glum expression on your face, because you are trying to sum a Fourier series of the form roughly 1 over n times sine of nx. I know why you're having trouble, because this Fourier series is not absolutely convergent. It is non-uniformly convergent. It exhibits a Gibbs phenomenon. And you can't answer the question just by looking at this series. You cannot answer the question, what is f of 0 or what is f of pi, because I don't have uniform convergence, and I cannot allow x to approach 0 or pi. I can't do that. But, you say, don't worry, I took a course at the perimeter, and I know what to do. And in one line, you do something magical. What is it that you do? You say, all I need to do is to accelerate the convergence of the Fourier series so that the Fourier series becomes uniformly convergent. How do I do that? I just happen to know one small fact in my head. I know this Fourier series. I can look it up in a book, but I'll tell you what it is. It happens to be the Fourier series for pi minus x over 2. Okay? And it's trivial. You can work it out. Just take the function, and you're going to do that in this afternoon. Expand pi minus x over 2 in a Fourier series. That's the Fourier series. Why is this Fourier series non-uniformly convergent? Because the function pi minus x over 2, this is the function f of x, f of 0 is equal to pi over 2, which is not 0. And that's the reason for the slow convergence. So you say to the guy, no problem. If this is the Fourier series that I have to evaluate, I will simply write it as two Fourier series. I know the asymptotic behavior of these Fourier coefficients, so I will write it as the following two Fourier series. First, there's the Fourier series sine of nx over n. And then there is the Fourier series sine of nx times e to the 1 over n minus 1 minus 1 over n. What could be more trivial? This is really simple. Why is this so wonderful? Because how does this behave as n goes to infinity? 1 over n squared. Okay, this behaves like 1 over n squared. Therefore, what can you tell me about this Fourier series? It is absolutely convergent, and therefore it is uniformly convergent. The convergence does not depend on x in any sensitive way. This is where the delicate convergence is. But I know how to sum the series. This series is just pi minus x over 2. And therefore, you say to the guy, the function that you're describing, the f of x, the function that you're trying to calculate, is this plus this Fourier series. And you say to the guy, this Fourier series converges uniformly and absolutely. In particular, I can use this Fourier series at 0 and at pi. Therefore, I know right away that f of 0 is equal to pi over 2. Because this vanishes. Okay? And it is a faithful representation of whatever this function is over here. Okay, I don't know what this function is. This is a very, very complicated function. I have no idea what it is. And I also know that f of pi is equal to 0. Why is that? Because this vanishes at 0. And of course, this vanishes at 0 because this faithfully represents the function. There isn't any rapid oscillation that confuses things. Furthermore, you say to the guy, this Fourier series here is very slowly convergent. I would need millions and millions and millions of terms to get you an accurate numerical value. But this Fourier series, this is wonderful. Because this Fourier series converges like 1 over n squared, so 10 terms in this Fourier series is going to give me a very, very accurate way to calculate the function f of x. That is what I mean by acceleration of convergence. Hang on, just one second. Now, can I do better? Maybe that's what you were going to discuss. Yeah. Well, of course, but compared with this, this is terrifically awful. I mean, this is about as disgusting as you can get, okay? This is much, much better. But I agree with you, it's not all that fast. So what do? We go to a book, and we look up the function. I don't happen to know the function, but we look up the function g of x, whose Fourier series is 1 over 2n squared times sine of nx. OK? There's some function here. And I can get it out of a book. And therefore, this guy's function, f of x, is equal to pi minus x over 2 plus g of x, which is some well-defined function, plus the sum from n equals 1 to infinity sine of x times e to the 1 over n minus 1, minus 1 over n, minus 1 over 2n squared. And how does this function behave for large n? Like 1 over n cubed. OK, this is going like 1 over n cubed. And you say to the guy, all we have to do is look in a book and find the function g of x. And now your Fourier series converges like 1 over n cubed. Now I don't even need 10 terms in the series to get a good representation of the function. I can use 3 terms. OK? And I can continue this process. And I can, and as you're talking, the face of this guy is getting happier by degrees, OK? That's all you have to say to the guy. You say, have a nice day, and you walk away, and you look over your shoulder, and this guy is smiling from ear to ear, because for the first time, he can extract the information from his problem. Bottom line. The bottom line is that he has had to solve a very hard problem. He reduced an extremely difficult problem to a series, which meant he was solving a sequence of very easy problems. And this is what he found. But his problem was he couldn't extract the answer because he didn't know how to sum the series. The series knew the answer, but he couldn't get the answer out of the series. But by acceleration of convergence, you can. And now, for the first time, you realize that you can use Fourier series to solve difficult problems. OK, yeah.
That arithmetic is not necessarily commutative, so how can you justify doing that?
Infinite
arithmetic is not necessarily
commutative. I didn't commute anything. No. You're absolutely right, but I didn't commute anything. I used the distributive rule. That's what I did.
Okay.
I used distributivity, and that's the trick of what I did. I never commuted terms, and I never put terms out of order. I distributed. So I used explicitly the distributive law of arithmetic, which is the one thing I believe, which is linearity, which explicitly says if I have a sum of the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, say alpha times a sub n plus beta times b sub n, this is equal to alpha times the sum of a sub n plus beta times the sum of b sub n. That's the distributive law. Okay, commutative would mean that I'm adding up the terms in the series in a different order. And if I should ever do that in a series that is not absolutely convergent, I will get the wrong answer. Furthermore, I cannot use the associative law, which we're going to talk about this either beginning on Friday or next week. You cannot use, in a slowly convergent series, you cannot use, or in a divergent series, the commutative law, that is, I can't add up the terms in a different order. You know, add the first term to the third term, and then the second term, and then the ninth term. If I add up the terms in a different order, I get the wrong answer. Okay? And if I try to associate terms, if I try to combine term 1 and 2, and term 3 and 4, and term 5 and 6, and term 7 and 8, I will get the wrong answer. That's the associative law. Arithmetic is not infinitely commutative, and it's not infinitely associative. OK, we're going to talk about it. OK? Yeah.
Yeah, but to actually get a Fourier series like this,
yeah,
wouldn't you need an initial condition that actually didn't satisfy your boundary conditions?
What do you mean?
Well, because let's say your initial condition is
Yes. You're right. You're almost right. It's not an initial condition. But it's really a boundary condition. Okay, it's what's happening at the boundary. So what we are going to do next time is we're going to solve this problem. This problem is a trivial problem. Okay, and the answer is written right here. okay? That's it. That's the answer. It's a trivial problem. Rapidly convergent Fourier series. You don't need to accelerate the convergence of this series. That exponential factor does everything you've ever wanted in a series. Okay? So that's not the problem. The problem is, what happens if we want to solve a serious physics problem? Okay, that is where this function is not zero, where this function is, let's say, h of t, and this function is, say, g of t. Because this is physics. Because now we're doing an actual experiment where we have a wire of length pi, and we're putting a temperature g of t, which is fluctuating in time, here, and a temperature h of t here, which is fluctuating in time. How do you solve that problem? And now, because this is not zero here at the boundary, and it's not zero at the boundary, if we try to use a Fourier series to solve this problem, our Fourier series is going to be slowly convergent. And the question is, how do we attack that problem? And we can solve that problem brilliantly by just using the trick I just showed you.
But is it even possible to have it be zero on these boundaries and equal to one all along the bottom boundary?
Oh, you're worried about what is called a corner layer. You're asking, do the zeros here conflict with the ones here? This is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. This is 0, 0, 0.
Right.
What happens in the corner? And the answer is the solution to the heat equation. This is it's a very nice question. And this has to do with what is called corner behavior. And the solution to the heat equation in this corner is smooth. Because the solution to the heat equation, diffusion, is a smoothing process. And it's infinitely smooth. And the answer is, in each of these corners, if you just take a tiny, if you just look at the neighborhood of the corner, the solution to the heat equation is constant along certain, along curves here. And as you rotate in theta, this smoothly goes from 0 up to 1. Okay? And I will show you, if you're interested afterward, I will show you how you study the corner behavior. You might say, this is incredible. How could it be that this goes from 1 to 0 in a smooth fashion? And the answer is, as you rotate in theta from 0 to 1 along any arc, it smoothly goes from 0 to 1, okay? Except at the singular point in 1, but that is at the initial condition. We're only solving the heat equation in the interior of this region, which is an open region, okay? So exactly at that corner, of course, there is a discontinuity. But that doesn't hurt the physics in any way.
And that's the Gibbs phenomenon, right?
And no, that's not the Gibbs. The Gibbs phenomenon is due to the fact that all of the functions in a Fourier sine series vanish at the boundary.
Right.
And this is one at the boundary. Okay? So, yeah. So let's stop here. And there, the tutors want to make an announcement.
So, my friends, first of all, next Wednesday, we're going to have the tutorial about Maple. So I would like to ask you, how many of you have the Maple program installed on your laptops? five, six people. So I will highly recommend that you install Maple on your laptops.
We can.
By
they
next.
Can't. They can't. They can't. Enjoy today.
Oh, they can.
Sorry.
Then if you can, please do this, because as a part of the agreement between Caribbean and Maple, we must have a special tutorial so that people from Maple come and explain how to use this program. But all of you must have it installed by that time. Then this is what Debbie asked me to tell.
Didn't you guys say that the woman from IT would come and install it for us? She never came.
She doesn't need to, so.
Well, she does, because we can install her.
No, we need to ask her. Installing Maple does not require administrative privileges.
Really?
Yes, because you have the package, and apparently you should follow some simple instructions from that package. Okay. This is concerning scientific computation course. So many of you have submitted homeworks and put this in the temporary folder. Yesterday, I wanted to look at your programs, and I couldn't open the files. I believe that files have simply disappeared from that folder. There could be numerous reasons for this. One is that the whole system in Perimeter Institute experienced some kind of interruption or crash or something like that. So I would like to ask you, to resubmit, not resubmit, but to email all your scientific computation programs to me or to Callum.
Then I to you.
Okay, to me, direct. And then we will probably split the job. So directly to me. So the first person who did this was Henry. So, and please, as soon as possible, email everything to me. So that we could check. Yeah.
Is this for all homeworks?
For all. So if you have submitted your first homework, and hopefully you have your first homework still in your laptop, please email all the files. And this is for all homeworks, 1, 2, and 3. Because it was not a wise decision to ask you to submit in the temporary form. And you see, we can't be responsible for what's going on with the system or on the protest server. Okay, is this clear?
I have an announcement.
Yes.
Okay, so today is the 19th, and what do we have today?
Workshop!
Right. You have to go to this workshop today, otherwise, you won't be able to graduate.
This is an announcement also for applications.
So those of you who are applying to PhD places and you need reference letters, email John Berlinski, and not only that, submit to John a copy of one of your applications, complete applications, you know, along with statement of purpose and like a transcript and things like that, so that, you know, not all of the applications, but at least one of them, just one of them, so that John can base his reference letter based on information contained in the application.
The essay, you mean?
Sorry?
Like the statement?
Yeah.
Part of
the board. Just give him stuff right about it.
Yeah. Statement, and then I guess you should also, some sort of transcript should also be. And also, so that John can, you know, base his partly based on the language, right?